If we allow God the kind of creative freedom that we allow some of our best artists, which is, it's not going to be as explicit as you would always like it to be, but it's going to be better for it.
But I guess I just, like, I have a hard time with that response, like, because viewing God as sort of like morally vague or morally ambiguous and viewing God's creation in that same light, it just strikes me as odd.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome to a show on deconstruction and reconstruction. We'll meet my guest, Inna Mo, both former members of well-known Christian bands today. And thanks to all who turned out for our discussion on sexuality, gender and identity. It was great to have so many unbelievable listeners in attendance for our live online show last Tuesday. If you missed it, it does get broadcast next week on the show. And in fact, the next live show is already available to book in for and register. It's an Ask Me Anything with the godfather of apologetics, William Lane Craig. Do go to unbelievable.live to register your place for that one in March. Now, if you want more from today's show, you want more from all of our podcast articles and resources, do go to the website, premierunbelievable.com, your one-stop shop for all things Premier Unbelievable. And while you are there, register for our newsletter, because among many other things, you'll get our ebook, Googling God, when you register. It answers the top five most Googled questions about faith, including how can I know that God is real and how can I know why we suffer? So if you want to do that, do register at the website, premierunbelievable.com. The link is with today's show. For now, let's jump into today's discussion. Well, today on the show, we're talking about Death to Deconstruction. That's the name of a new book. And we're asking, can ex-evangelicals reconstruct their faith? Josh Porter is a punk singer turned pastor based out in Washington, whose book Death to Deconstruction, Reclaiming Faithfulness as an Act of Rebellion, charts his own journey towards deconstruction. He says, I was given every conceivable reason to abandon the Christian ship, but tells why his faith didn't end up getting shipwrecked. Well, he's in conversation today with another musician, John Steingard, formerly of the band Hawk Nelson, who in 2020 kind of underwent a public deconstruction of his own. We've spoken to John once or twice on the show in the past couple of years, and he's back to tell us where he's at currently on his journey and interact with Josh on his case against deconstruction. So John and Josh, welcome to the show today.
Thanks for having
Thanks.
Us, man.
Yeah, it's great to meet you, Josh, and good to see you again, Justin.
Likewise.
Good to see you guys. Thank you for joining me. Josh, let's start with you as a newcomer to the show, as it were. Tell us a little bit of your story. In fact, the book starts at quite a dramatic and dark place, a point where you were considering suicide. Do you want to sort of explain how you opened the book?
Yes, I wrote a draft of the book, which sort of chronicles my faith upbringing. I was raised in the rural deep south of the United States and kind of against a backdrop of fundamentalism and conservatism. And this was in the, 80s and 90s, the sort of satanic panic era where there was an extreme allergic reaction to art and culture. And I was wired, my personality to a fault is sort of wired against the grain of, a homogenized cultural environment. I'm sort of bent toward rebellion or a sort of, probing and asking questions. Again, to a fault, but that is my wiring and personality. And so that sort of created this combustible recipe for someone who was raised in the church and with a genuine, not just a curiosity, but a sincere desire to figure out what it meant to believe in God or read the Bible or be a Christian, and felt as if I, couldn't quite find my place. Eventually found punk rock music and spent years and years traveling the world, playing in a band. And I, like many people my age, and certainly like many people raised in an environment like mine, entered into a very messy process of what all Christians experience as spiritual formation, but for me teetered toward and eventually became a deconstruction, I hesitate to use a word like journey, but a period of my life where the pieces, the theological framework that I was given in my upbringing was certainly called into question. Most of that was on the chopping block, but it came to a point where sort of the foundational aspects of doctrinal aspects of Orthodox Christianity were also called into question or on the chopping block. And I was asking myself very serious questions about whether I would be a Christian or even a theist or whatever return to something like church or a traditional reading of the scriptures. And I had written a draft of a book that essentially told that story and resolved that particular narrative, meaning I was raised in this environment. I got dealt a really bad hand in, you know, kind of evangelical conservative Christianity. I wanted out. These are the things that I wrestled with. Here's how I personally resolved them. If it's helpful for you, here you go. And I realized when I had completed that draft that it sort of resolved with me narratively. It resolved with me becoming a pastor, you know, sort of cemented in Orthodox Christianity. And it read as if that was the happy ending of the story. When in reality, you know, anyone who follow any person, let alone a person who follows Jesus, understands that, you know, life oscillates between seasons of peace and chaos and joy and despair. And that doesn't end when one decides to follow Jesus or even when one completes a season of deconstruction and commits to one view against another view. And the truth was, is that post my deconstruction phase of discipleship, I had experienced probably the hardest seasons of my life personally, and, you know, a kind of snowballing internal struggle with things like self-loathing and despair reached a fever pitch. And the reality was that the darkest period of my life took place while I was committed to the ancient historic Orthodox, you know, movement of Jesus. And so for me, the word, you know, lots of people have asked me again and again, why give your book such a pointed, provocative title, especially since deconstruction is such a nuanced and varied word. And what about good deconstruction? And I thought, honestly, aesthetically and artistically, it would be interesting to give the word deconstruction a multi-layered meaning in the book. So deconstruction refers to the obvious junk drawer pop culture or spiritual pop culture vernacular of the process of jettisoning one's faith or aspects of one's faith. But it also, for me, refers to something much bigger, the deconstruction of someone's life or the deconstruction of one's mental health, the erosion of stability and the deconstruction of one's will to live. So in the book, it, you know, I infer one meaning at the beginning. There's kind of the pop culture spiritual meaning that I unpack in like chapter one or something like that. But hopefully by the narrative's conclusion, it's taken on a much more complicated and dense meaning that then breathes new life into the title. But unfortunately, it's one of those things that you actually have to read to get at it.
It. Well, I guess, you know, I appreciate the way in which you did decide to kind of give it that beginning, because no journey is ever over till it's over, and you can't always wrap things up in a pretty bow. And and in a way, that's why we've got John on, because he's kind of been charting his journey sort of publicly, but not so publicly lately. John, you've kind of like retired almost for a while, at least from Twitter and Instagram, haven't you? What's going on?
Why have
you become a recluse now?
So I mean, first off, Josh, before I say anything about myself, I just want to say I am glad you're still here. I'm glad you chose to keep going, and I'm glad you are expressing yourself, and congratulations on writing a book. Like, putting your thoughts together in a book form is no small feat. And so I just, right off the bat, I wanted to say, like, congrats on that, because that's a big deal.
Thanks, man.
In your life.
Yeah, thank you,
dude. And I also just a little asterisk here. You mentioned you were in a band. Some people online will know the name of your band, and it is Showbread. And I say that enthusiastically because my wife and I, when we were dating, loved Showbread. Like, I think she was probably wearing a Showbread shirt when I met her, you know?
Oh,
so,
wow.
I mean, like, or it was in that era, so it may have been statistically possible, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, I just wanted to say, man, it's like, it's pretty cool to talk to you. So
thanks,
just right out of the gate.
Well, we're old peers. We traveled in the same circles for many years.
We played right ahead of you at Cornerstone 2006. Seven or something like that, right in front of you. And I remember being like, the tent was packed full of like sort of hardcore emo screamo kids, and we were this like pop punk band that everyone was like, yeah, let's get past this, guys. This is commercial crap. So anyway, but my background in a, no, well, you know, it's just, we found ourselves in that position every once in a while. We're playing next to all these like legit, bands, and we're like the pop act that everyone's embarrassed about. So my background is, I was in this band Hawk Nelson for 15 years. Toward the end of my time in the band, I started having some questions about my faith, probably some of the same questions that you wrestled with, Josh. A lot of people do. And those questions sort of expanded. I kept on finding more and more things that I was like, ooh, I don't know about that. I actually didn't know the word deconstruction during that period for myself. I only discovered it later once I started talking publicly, because I eventually wrote a post saying like, hey, I don't think I believe in God anymore. Here's some reasons why. And that post sort of like demarcated a pretty serious shift in my life, as you can imagine.
Sure.
But over the next little while, I discovered, oh, this is a process. What I've just been through is something that a bunch of other people have been going through or are going through. I went through it very much alone. I wasn't a part of a social group that was going through anything like that. All of my friends were Christian, pretty much. And still to this day, most of my friends are Christian. The word deconstruction for me was actually helpful in the sense that when I realized there was a word for what I was going through, or even if the word was incorrect, like forget about Derrida and all that stuff, like, sure, like even if the word is totally incorrect, the fact that people were using a word was actually really meaningful to me, because it meant I'm like not the only person to go through this process, which is freaking terrifying and horrifying and like not what I was looking for at all. I'm like, I'm sure you relate to some of that, Josh. So, in the years since then, I've just discovered there's this huge, huge swath of philosophy and theology out there, and I felt humbled by the scope of it the more I learned. Which, Justin, you mentioned that you've noticed that I've been online less. I think the more I learned, like I started a podcast because I was so excited about talking about this stuff, and like I felt like my world was opening. And then as I discovered how wide the world of philosophy of religion and theology is, I just felt a little humbled by that. And I felt like I should probably take a step back and maybe not present I wasn't presenting myself as an expert exactly, but like I didn't want to even be misconstrued as that. And so that's what's caused me to sort of be a little quieter recently.
It's really interesting to hear that, John. I guess there is that temptation to sort of, as soon as you've said no to something, think, well, now I have to kind of start to champion something else. But I think it's very humble, as you say,
There's another layer there in that. And Josh, you know, you might know this feeling a little bit. The 15 years I was in a band, that when you're in a band, your survival depends on holding people's attention. And so I think I internalized that to such a degree that once I went through this process, I was like, well, I don't know what the future holds. It's important to continue to hold people's attention. Now, I don't think I consciously thought that, but I think there was something in there that was causing me to try and stay in the limelight. I'm not putting that on anybody else. I just noticed that in myself. And I was like, you know what? Probably be healthy for me to learn how to be a little more private. That's the journey I've been on more recently is a much privater one.
Well, Josh, tell us a bit about your journey as well, because obviously you spelled it out briefly just in your introduction there. You say you grew up in this quite conservative fundamentalist kind of Christian background. You obviously adopted a quite, in a sense, countercultural anarchist punk kind of, you know, lifestyle and so on. I'm sure that itself was a bit of a challenge to many of your family and people in your church and so on. I guess at what point did you feel like there was too much of a grating up against, you know, I don't know, the doctrines you were hearing, the the things you were being told in church versus what you were experiencing in the world. At what point, I guess, did you kind of get to that point where you thought, you know, I'm not sure I can stay in this faith any longer?
Well, I think that, you know, the misconception about me when I was younger was that Josh is constantly teetering in his faith, even as like an adolescent and a young adult, because I had lots of questions and I, by default, kind of challenged normative readings of scripture and doctrine. Mm. And there was, if I'm being completely honest, there was certainly a dimension of immaturity there. And like I said, I called my book Death to Deconstruct. So I still have this, you know, like tendency to provoke for the sake of provoking. I find it, you know, interesting creatively, but I also immaturely carry that into my, you know, kind of personal life. And so there was an element of that, but there was an honest, sincere, like I'm trying to work this out and I need to understand. And so I need a place where the welcoming of things like doubt or questions, or even a place where it's okay to say something like, do we know that God exists? And how do we know that God, you know, that kind of thing, where those are mm-hmm. questions that were horrifying to ask in my immediate environment. I didn't think that they were, because I was coming at them from an angle of I'm genuinely trying to understand, also mm-hmm. wrapped up in this kind of immature, rebellious teenage and, you know, 20-something. And so the world around me responded with some amount of hostility or pushback at the very least, and understandably so, because they couldn't separate the Josh, the rebellious provocateur, from Josh, the sincere wrestler, if you like. And so there was kind of, you know, this, you've always had a problem with authority. You just need to accept these things and get in line. And if maybe, you know, maybe you're in sin, or maybe you are listening to the wrong kind of music, or we knew this would happen because you like punk rock music, that kind of thing. And maybe, I don't know, maybe there was some element of truth in some of those things, but I found them all obviously ultimately unhelpful, because I'm like, well, fine, sure, but can someone help me understand freaking Leviticus or some such thing? And so honestly, a lot like John, you know, you step out of the narrow paradigm of your initial world. And for me, that happened not just on tour, but, you know, like John, I just started reaching for books, and with no guide at all. I was, you know, reading alone, and would find a theologian that really stirred something up in me. And it wasn't necessarily that I opened a book and was like, wow, I'm going to change my entire worldview. It was just the idea that even Orthodox Christianity, let alone the, you know, outside of the bounds of Orthodox Christianity, were so wide, and there was so much writing and thinking that it was exciting. It was almost like finding out, you know, there's a new genre of music, I really like it, and there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of bands. You're like, oh, well, geez, like I've not begun to plumb the depths. And so, you know, that it for me became the deconstruction phase was marked by a militant, excited grabbing onto new theological concepts, because I would read something that was very intellectually stimulating and be like, that has got to be it. It makes so much more sense. And it's the opposite of what I was told before, which is, again, speaks to my immaturity, because I kind of liked the idea of sticking it to the man by believing the opposite of what I was told. But then honestly, there was still the sincere wrestling and reading and being like, oh, I don't know about this. Yeah, I don't know what I believe about these things anymore, and this or that way to read. And this sounds like a really pretentious thing to say, but it wasn't until years into like a grad school and, you know, doing the whole biblical studies and, you know, a master's degree in theology that I went in there thinking like, I'm already going to know more than these guys, 'cause I read all the time. And, you know, 2 years into an experience like that, and I felt as if all my militant theological perspectives were not burned away by me being challenged by ideas necessarily, but being challenged by people sitting on either side of me that, like, well, this guy's very nice and he sure thinks the thing that I thought was so terrible. I wonder what that means. It doesn't make it true, but what does that mean? And I had kind of in my early years, deconstruction years, and then in my, if you want to call it, reconstruction years, had always gravitated toward theological paradigms and categories because they were simpler, and I liked the idea of being settled in a position. Ambiguity was scary, and you know, and that's probably has to do with the fundamentalist upbringing to some degree. And you know, I felt as if there was a period, even in like seminary, when I was like, I don't know, I could end up anything at the end of this. I feel so malleable and I feel so open to possibilities. Yeah. I'm no longer threatened by ideas that seem contrary to either my upbringing or the ones that I needed, quote unquote, to be true during deconstruction. And that happened, honestly, a lot like John, through just the wider world of thinking.
Yeah. I mean, to that extent, it strikes me very often that, you know, as we know, deconstruction has different meanings to different people. I mean, at one point in your book, you call it an aggressive, cancerous outgrowth of the ordinary transforming we all do. But I think to some people, it is more a transforming thing. It's maybe just moving out of a very particular instantiation of a cultural form of Christianity and realizing, oh, the world is much bigger than I thought. And maybe there are other ways to think about the first chapters of Genesis. Maybe there are other ways to think about other issues and so on. And I don't know, John, whether for you kind of, you were kind of going on a theological journey at the moment, but when you put that Instagram post out there in 2020, where you said, mm-hmm. I am now finding that I no longer believe in God, had you kind of gone on this journey with Josh, or did you kind of go on that journey afterwards more, or what was the process for you, John?
Well, I mean, at that point, I think I had recently, it was a process of like one issue at a time for me. Whereas, like, I spent a lot of time really obsessed with heaven and hell and where are ideas of heaven and hell and sort of salvation and, like, what does the Bible say about salvation really? And, evolution. I mean, the version of Christianity I grew up in was basically, like, if you believe in evolution, you're not a Christian.
Sure.
So I mean, I know plenty of people don't believe that anymore. Like, obviously, it's very common to meet Christians that believe in evolution, theistic evolution, versions of evolution, whatever. But that was one of the things that I also studied. And so like a bunch of issues sort of piled up, and probably the most salient one was textual criticism, like biblical textual criticism. And once I got to that, I got to a point where I was like, well, if I am distrustful of even scripture, then what do I really know about God and where did I learn it? And once I got to that point, I was like, well, I don't know that I can, what if I don't believe in this at all? Like the entire thing. And it was like, I remember having, it was a few months before the post that I sort of had that thought. And I mean, it wasn't a welcome thought. I felt very, very vulnerable. Because for a long time, well, my whole life, I had always believed that there was a loving God looking out for me and, you know, guiding my steps and having a plan for my life. And to lose that idea is very, very disorienting. I a little bit bristle sometimes when I hear, and I'm not putting this on you, Josh, but I've heard other people say, you know, like sort of be very dismissive about deconstruction. And yes, there are examples of people going through a process of deconstruction where it's very socially guided and it's trendy and hip or whatever. But there's also, I know a lot of people that have been very thoughtful in their process. And I hope that I am one of those people where I really, you know, wanted to believe true things. And I found that the more I looked at the things I had grown up believing, the harder time I had believing a lot of those things. And it took actually probably a year or two after that to really find my footing and just living my life and not feeling like terrified about existential problems. So, yeah,
I appreciate that, man. I can really, really relate to it. And I think that like you, I would like to say, and with some amount of integrity, that, you know, I believe that my deconstruction was a thoughtful and deliberate process as well. You know,
it sounds like it.
Yeah, you know, and Justin's over here trying to get me in trouble from reading pull quotes from the book about cancerous outgrowth. I think, you know, honestly, part of it for me
I did highlight that part of your book when I read it. But
When I decided to take the angle of less of like, you know, originally there was maybe I'll write a book that's just theological arguments against some of the primary quibbles that people have with evangelical Christianity. And that idea began to bore me at some point. So when I took up the angle of like, I would like to tell a very raw and vulnerable story about myself and my own deconstruction, you know, it was Nietzsche of all people that was most inspirational to the title. I always thought that Nietzsche's whole God is dead thing was so fascinating because, you know, when you read the whole anecdote about the shattered lantern and from the gay science, the argument is not necessarily for the actual death of God or that Nietzsche believed that God was dead, but more of this literary, interesting and analogous kind of philosophical argument. But somehow it became the banner over everything this guy thought and did. And it terrified Christians, you know, still terrifies Christians, and kind of gave Nietzsche's disciples a banner under which to rally that isn't necessarily perfectly indicative of what he was arguing in the gay science. So,
Totally agree.
I thought it would be interesting to write something called Death to Deconstruction that is about a person deconstructing. So, you know, immediately there was like this kind of aggressive, not from you, John, because you're actually a nice guy, but there was this aggressive, blind, you know, like rallying against the book that's like, no, but screw this guy because I did deconstruction really well. And I'm like, well, if you in the first paragraph, you'd probably realize that it's a book about somebody deconstructing. So I wanted something that, you know, and, you know, I was in a band for years and the tagline of the band was Music is Dead. And we played music. So I think that this is like thematically something that I'm borrowing and doing again and again and again. The idea of the interesting, if not slightly misleading title, but that is sincere if you can kind of, you know, unpack it a little bit. But I don't disagree with what you're saying, John. And I've been in those places too. And not in the sense that like, oh, I've been and I graduated and now I'm smarter. I just mean that I can relate, you know, I can relate.
Yeah. Great stuff. We'll go to a quick break, guys. And it's a good introduction to both of your journeys and what's led you to this place. We'll maybe talk about some of what you describe as the great predators in your book, Josh. Biblical illiteracy, the problem of evil, political Christianity, hypocrisy, self-denial. Some of these catalysts, if you like, for deconstruction. And we'll see what John wants to respond to among those. We're talking about deconstruction. Josh Porter's new book is called Death to Deconstruction. He's in conversation with John Steingard here on Unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back. We're talking about deconstruction on the show today. Something actually we seem to quite often do with Christian musicians of one form or another. It wasn't that long ago that I had Audrey Assad talking about her sort of deconstruction journey on the show, opposite Father Chris Foley, who himself was of a punk rock band of sorts. I guess, Josh, you know the band Luxury. They were.
Kind I do. Of yeah, he actually reached out to me just recently, and what an honor it was to hear from first generation Tooth and Nail.
What is it about musicians and their deconstruction journeys then, Josh? Is it is this just the fact that maybe you guys have more of a platform, so we tend to hear these stories more from you? Or is there something that goes with the kind of artistic deconstruction thing? I don't know.
Well, I can only speak to my personal experience. I haven't done a survey or anything, but I think that I know that, you know, anecdotally, this was something that happened to my band and to a lot of bands where we came of age in Christian culture, and especially in American evangelical Christian culture. And a lot of bands were sort of born out of like a youth group kind of mentality where we're reaching for and finding credible indie music, if you like, for the first time, and realizing that the kinds of bands that we'd like to listen to, there are people who claim to follow Jesus and also make music. And so we were being inspired by those bands to do the same thing. And then there was an immediate sort of, in many cases, enthusiasm that would surround these, like, oh my God, these guys are going to do it. And look at that. They love Jesus and their little band. And you guys should get out there and do your thing. And then without any kind of theological education, and I don't mean that they should go to seminary or some sort of thing, but without like a robust understanding of what they believe, and certainly no communal backing, because you live in a van and drive around, you know, as a micro community. And that's often a place where emotional unhealthiness kind of thrives and, you know, interpersonal dysfunction thrives. And there's no one to ask. There's only the next venue, the next dive bar. And so a lot of the things that you take for granted either wither from atrophy, or they just don't hold up against the big backdrop of the world, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, before we talk about these particular issues in Josh's book, does that ring true for you as well, John, with as a musician who went through this? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I remember just feeling like a lot of kids were looking at us and looking to us for inspiration, positivity, spiritual guidance at times in a way. And I remember feeling like, I'm not a pastor, like I'm not equipped for this. And it, you know, in retrospect, I look back and I go, wow, like the Christian music world is full of people who are writing music sometimes as if they're speaking from God's perspective. Like, I remember I wrote a song, the biggest song I ever wrote in Christian music was a song of ours called Drops in the Ocean. And the song is written from God's perspective, looking down on you and based, not in a bad way, but like, you know, encouraging and lifting up people. But it's written from that perspective. And looking back, I kind of go like, well, that's bold. but without any theological training, that I'm writing from God's perspective, but it was accepted by the Christian music community as true enough, you know? And, so I agree. There's the potential when you put someone in front of people and give them a microphone and don't require a lot of training. I think there's potential problems there. I don't know what the solution to that is. I have nothing to offer there, but but I relate to that. And I felt motivated to learn because as I, you know, got in front of more and more people as the singer of the band, I remember thinking like, I really need to know more about theology and I need to feel more confident about why I believe what I believe. And that ended up being what got me in a lot of trouble.
That'll do it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, in a way, I'd love to talk more about that. But I feel like we should address some of the specifics that were a kind of common catalyst, as you sort of put them in the book, Josh. Biblical illiteracy, the problem of evil, political Christianity, hypocrisy, self-denial. Now, I've heard all of these mentioned in different stories in different ways, and I'm sure they all factored at some level in your story, Josh. John, we're probably going to major on two of these because I think two of them are probably of most interest to you, biblical illiteracy and the problem of evil. Josh, do you want to start with biblical illiteracy and just sketch out kind of what you have to say about that in the book and the way in which you found it's a common theme in deconstruction?
Yes. The pushback that I've heard so far against using biblical illiteracy as one of the catalysts for deconstruction is, in simplistic terms, oh, he's just saying if we just knew how to read the Bible, then we wouldn't have any problems with it. But that's not the argument that I make in the book at all. I do believe, however, that many of the consistently, you know, at least brought before me as a pastor and previously, you know, as a guy who went around playing music and claimed to be a Christian and was a Christian, that kind of arguments or gripes I'm hearing against the scriptures, a lot of them, I think, are a result of biblical illiteracy, meaning you're mad at the Bible for things the Bible doesn't actually say, or you're mad at the Bible because we haven't been taught how to read it. And I don't mean, I realize there's no way to say that without sounding like I'm some kind of arrogant person who's cracked the code. I haven't. But I think that, and this goes back to something that, that John was just talking about as well. I think that in those little hubs of certainly an evangelical Christianity, we haven't been given a robust paradigm for the spiritual discipline of art appreciation, and we haven't been taught what it means to honor and support artists who follow Jesus in the specific place that they hold in the kingdom of God. And so the best that we can do is either discourage them from their vocation by being like, it's not a real job, which is kind of the common critique and a lot of what I heard. Or we say, hey, I mean, I guess best of luck to you. I don't know anything about that. Do your thing, I guess, rather than, you know, creating sort of an environment where as best as we can offer accountability and vulnerability and support to artists so that somebody like me or John, who's writing a song from God's perspective, can say, hey, is this a dumb thing to do? You know, it's something that I've done as well. And someone might say, like, I don't know, let's talk about it. What does it mean? You know, and the Bible, I think, is regardless of whether or not you think it's the orthodox understanding of, you know, divinely inspired, authoritative in the lives of disciples of Jesus, it is, I think, rightly understood as one of the most sophisticated works of literary genius ever committed to paper. And it's all the things that I love about a work of art. It's outrageous. It's offensive. It's ambiguous. It's shocking. It's provocative. It's also uplifting and encouraging and beautiful. And there's, you know, poetry, there's narrative, there's discourse, there's, I think, deliberately unresolved tensions. And then there's questions that don't get answered. There's questions that do get answered, but that call the previous questions back into question again. It's everything that I love about a dense, sophisticated work of art. But I was never taught to understand the Bible as a work of art, because in my upbringing, if you use that kind of language to describe the scriptures, that was synonymous to saying it's not true, or, you know, metaphor means not true. Mm. Symbolism means not true. Or if you describe the book as a work of art rather than, you know, a sort of divine tablet crafted by the hand of God himself, it calls our allegiance to the scriptures into question. And it's not, it's an understandable place to arrive when one hasn't been given a robust perspective on the scriptures, because how is a story authoritative? How is a poem authoritative? How is a history lesson authoritative? And in what way? And how do we read ancient genres of literature for which there is no modern equivalent? And how are we supposed to understand? Yeah. Can we understand those? And so I think that just because we can understand what the Bible is and how to read it better does not mean that it will resolve all of our questions or conflicts with the scriptures. Mm. I still have tons of them, and my job, full-time job, is to teach the Bible. But I think that understanding what the Bible is intended to be can, in many cases, alleviate a lot of the concerns and existential crises that become the I don't even know if I can do this at all anymore, at least in my personal narrow sample size.
So what's your journey with the Bible being like, John, then?
Josh, like, I agree on a lot of that. I do think the Bible is unique as far as human literature in human history. I think it is a lot. Basically, everything you just said, I agree with. I would pull two words out of what you just said and sort of like poke at those, and they'd be authoritative and allegiance, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, I agree that it's an incredible work of literature, but we all agree it was written by human beings, right? It's what we layer on top of that I take issue with. And what gets layered on top of that is, oh, we can consider it authoritative in our lives. Well, what do we mean by that? So, like, I guess I take issue with, as soon as we take that to a place where we're saying, like, this is going to tell us how to live our lives because this is God speaking to us. Like, I was very much taught that, like, when you read the Bible, this is essentially, treat this as God speaking to you. And that's the bit that I just don't see justification for. Like, that to me is a choice based on faith, which is fine if you want to say it like that and be like, I have faith that God inspired these words and that's why I follow it. That, to me, I understand, but I was raised in a tradition that valued biblical inerrancy. So it's just like, you can't question, this is the word of God. And then mm-hmm. you get into arguments, like even in your book, you talk about the long ending of Mark, right? And how like yeah. the last few verses were added later. And, you know, that I didn't know about that until I went through a process of deconstruction. And I'm like, wait, mm-hmm. you're telling me there's stuff in the Bible that wasn't originally in the Bible? Like, that blew my mind. And I started getting into debates with people about translations and scribes copying and the age of manuscripts and all this stuff. And I was missing the point. And the point, I think, is like upstream of all of that, even if we had all the original writings, which we don't, we are, you know, Christians, generally speaking, will layer on top of those writings a layer of authority that's entirely faith-based. It's not based on anything other than that. And I just don't see sufficient justification to say, like, yeah. you know, someone a couple thousand years ago wrote this down and I should consider that as God speaking to me today. I just don't see justification.
Yeah. So fundamentally, you agree artistic, an yeah. amazing work of literature.
Yes.
Extraordinary influence. All of the above.
Undeniably.
Except
yeah.
still a work, as far as you can see, of human hands and no need necessarily to give it a kind of divine imprint.
To me, it's just
that.
Unbelievably Josh, human. Like, yeah. just to touch on that okay. for a second before you jump in, Josh, like yeah. sometimes you hear people say, like, well, you know, I could improve the Bible. I would just include everything that's in the Bible, but take away slavery. Like, I've heard people say that, and that's cheeky, whatever. But, like, the point is, if the Bible was essentially, like, inspired by God and that God wanted it written exactly as it's written, you would expect it to look different than it does, I think. You would expect it to have a consistent morality. But morality seems to shift throughout the documents. And, like, again, we're not here to debate all that stuff, but there are many things, I think, that are surprising given that hypothesis. Whereas, like, if you just look at it as like human beings, a reflection of their culture, wrote things down, and their culture was embedded in it. And of course, you see these inconsistencies. You see these things that change over time. Like, of course you do. Like, that's what you would expect. So anyway, that's
yeah, yeah.
Go Dude, ahead, I'm going to do what you did the other way around. I agree with what you said.
yeah.
I do. I think that I don't, you know, other than where we will obviously diverge, I don't take issue with anything that you said. I think that the Bible is, you know, I like the language from the Bible Project of the Bible is a library of writings, both human and divine, that together tell a unified story that leads to Jesus. I think emphasizing the human authors of the scripture is something sorely missing. And even if you...
Well, what's the justification for adding the divine part?
It's exactly what you said. I don't believe that you can reach a conclusion about divine authorship apart from faith.
Faith.
And
okay.
Yes,
yeah.
yes.
And we agree.
Totally. So I don't disagree with that either.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, at least from my personal perspective or my experience with the scriptures, that to me was also something that seemed for a very long time untenable for the same reasons as you. And not to say like, oh, and then I figured out something that you didn't figure out.
Fine.
I just, I can relate. I think that for me, counterintuitively, one of the things that alleviated some of my reservations about the scriptures was the same thing that you cite as a question mark, which is if the Bible has a divine co-author, meaning through however you want to describe theologically the process of inspiration and dictation, you know, you would expect it to sound different. You would expect it to be written quite differently. You would expect a certain level of consistency, and you would certainly expect less ambiguity, and you would expect certain core issues to be explicit, you know, rather than confusing. unless you begin to understand God as an artist. I think of God as the eccentric artist. You know, if you read, even according to the scripture standards, every time God appears to anyone, it's with all kinds of extreme exaggerated
drama.
Imagery, drama. Yeah. Anytime God invites people into an experience of his presence, it's like the tabernacle has to be decorated. Like there's got to be music and blood and a chorus, you know, and he shows up with like spiritual beings covered in eyeballs and it's so excessive, you know, and sometimes it seems pointlessly excessive and eccentric. Like, if you want Peter to go tell the Gentiles about Jesus, just say, hey, Peter, go down the street, turn left, knock on the door, and tell this guy that Jesus is, you know, the Messiah of Israel and now the Savior of the Gentiles as well. Instead, it's like a blanket comes down full of alligators and, you know, shellfish. And Peter's like, what is any of this supposed to mean? It sounds to me so bizarre and so hopelessly unnecessary unless God is an eccentric artist. That to me sounds like the behavior of an eccentric artist who, and one of the ways that human beings neurologically understand the world around them primarily is through the vehicle of story, you know, and through narrative and through, you know, imagery. It's why we are a people of movies, a people of the novel, you know. And I think that, for me personally, and I know that you could write this off by saying like, well, of course, because you like weird art, you've you understand the Bible is weird art, so you found a way in. But I think that if we allow God the kind of creative freedom that we allow some of our best artists, which is, it's not going to be as explicit as you would always like it to be, but it's going to be better for it. And it's not always going to be as you know, traditionally consistent as you would expect it to be, but it could be better for it. You know, and you bring up morality, which is great. And another thing that, you know, still bothers me to this day, I don't pretend to have no issues with the scriptures at all. But, you know, it's a lot like watching, you know, one of our most talked about movies this year is the Tar, starring Cate Blanchett, which is a very morally ambiguous movie that presents an EGOT composer who might also be a predator of young women. And rather than present a consistent ideological portrait of, so this is wrong, here's what she's doing that's evil, and now we can, the viewer, pass judgment on this character. I think one of the reasons that it has found an audience and resounds with that audience is that it gives the viewer a lot of autonomy and assigns them a certain degree of maturity and says, these are things that you're going to have to wrestle with, but if you do, that will enrich your experience fundamentally. So I do think that the Bible is the kind of book that you can open and you can know, okay, Jesus, and there's the story. Yep, he's on the cross. Okay, he comes back to life. You know, those, I don't pretend to like, oh, the scriptures are so hopelessly complicated, unless you have a degree, you'll never be a Christian. But I think it's the kind of art that's designed to be read over a lifetime without giving up all its secrets. And that to me is exciting rather than dissuasive.
John?
I mean, to some degree, I agree with some of that because I do feel like there is this sense of whimsy to life in general. So I also sense. So I relate to that. But I guess I just like, I have a hard time with that response, like, because viewing God as sort of like morally vague or morally ambiguous and viewing God's creation in that same light is a strange approach for, it just strikes me as odd because, I mean, at least in the Christian streams that I'm used to encountering, people tend to think of right and wrong as in most cases fairly black and white. And obviously for those that believe in heaven and hell, that's a binary. There's a binary there, right? Like, it's like, you're not kind of going to heaven and kind of going one or the other, right? And so the sort of morally ambiguous stuff, like, it seems really problematic to me in light of that. Now,
Totally.
If you want to endorse Christian Universally, I will reach through this camera and I will shake your hand because I would love if every Christian would be a universalist because I think it solves some internal problems for Christianity. It's the only version of Christianity that I think is plausible, but that's probably another show. So, Yeah, I just think the moral ambiguity is a problem.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. To be clear, I don't think that God is morally ambiguous, and I do not believe that the scriptures are fundamentally morally ambiguous. I think that they include some amount of aesthetic ambiguity that contributes to a story that is comprehensively consistent. I mean, the easiest things to go to are things like, well, why doesn't the Bible explicitly condemn something like polygamy in one story but seems to do it in other stories? Or why does the Bible consistently comment on moral failure in a way that's like bad, bad, good, good? And I think that it, like a movie, is designed to be experienced as a whole and thus, you know, paints a consistent moral picture from beginning to end.
But like, what about the people that like lived in those times, right? Like Deuteronomy 20 talks about, you know, God seems to command Israel to take slaves. And so like, I get if we're looking from the time that we're at now that you could make the argument like, oh, God wants to show us a progression of, you know, humanity getting better, or you could make some sort of progressive argument there. But what about the people that lived then? Like, how is that, it just doesn't, it feels weird to me if you considered God as like a divine co-author, seems like there would be a consistent morality all the way through. And I don't believe that there is. And so, you know, we maybe disagree on that, you know, but.
Yeah, totally. I mean, and I don't pretend to have all the answers, and I don't mean to treat these questions or complications of yours as if they are inconsequential, because I still have issues with the scriptures that are yet to be resolved. And I don't mean to kind of sweep it all under the rug of faith.
No, not totally.
For the sake of not putting Justin to sleep over here, he's just staring at us.
I'm
interested in hearing kind of where you do land though on this particular issue. I mean, right. Slavery, you know, John won't be the only person who scratched their heads over that. And I mean, John's suggested, well, maybe you're going to say there's some kind of progressive narrative that, you know, what do you say to that question though of well, what does God think of slavery? Okay. And how are we supposed to get to a point by the end of reading the Bible and the story of Jesus where we take a particular perspective on that? And, you know, because on the one hand, the artistic analogies and everything are wonderful, but some people do want to kind of have a black and white sort of statement at the end of it, don't they?
They do. Yeah. And I agree. You know, for me, there is a willingness to accept certain questions in light of the whole meaning. I don't pretend to have never read any. I mean, I'm pretty open about this in the book. You read things in the Bible, I'm like, well, I don't like that at all. Why the heck is this in here? And, you know, and there were other things that I brought very sincerely to people in my life that I respected and said, how come this is in here? And was given no answers. I think in some cases because there was an apprehension about opening Pandora's box, and in other cases because they had no idea. I think personally that I'm not alone in this, but I think it's not a novel new opinion. I think that the scriptures paint a consistent portrait of human dignity that renders a concept like our modern notions of slavery incomprehensible. You know, I think that the same, and it's not like by the time you get to New Testament, by the time you get to Paul, I think that like even early on in Levitical law and the Torah, the concern for the foreigner, the concern for the oppressed and the outsider, and the valuing of the other over the tribe itself is so such a predominant aspect of the character of God that I can see that narrative motif carried on from Genesis to Revelation. And certainly in the, you know, writings of the New Testament and the early church, the two caveats I would make in terms of slavery, which I know is just, geez, you guys couldn't have picked a worse word to just send jolts through the listener. is that, you know, throughout history, slavery has been understood in several different vague paradigms. If you're an American and you hear the word slavery, your mind immediately goes to American slavery and the slave, you know, the slave trade of just heinous, unspeakable evil, trafficking human beings and that kind of thing. But there's a missing dimension of slavery in the, you know, pop culture vernacular. And that's that, you know, if you go buy a jacket at H&M, you're funding modern slavery, and that we still to this day traffic in, you know, innumerable children into the slave trade to make Nikes or, you know, like digital products, that kind of thing. So we tend to bristle at certain concepts of slavery and give permission to others. Historically speaking, it seems to me...
I think anybody here would bristle at any of those versions of slavery. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think we're... like, I don't go to H&M and be like, I feel really good about the fact that someone's in this particular kind of... like, there's no version of slavery that most people actually think is okay now. We might have...
pragmatically.
Yeah. So I guess, like, I get what you're saying about H&M and, like, and that kind of thing, but there's a difference between, like, trying to go through your life and going, like, oh, man, there's certain products that I buy that might be maybe hypothetically creating a bad situation for someone. That's very different than Deuteronomy 20, where God specifically seems to be saying, they will do forced labor for you. Go to this town, take them over. They will do forced labor for you. Numbers 31, where it seems to talk about Israel taking sex slaves, and God seems totally fine with that. Hosea, you know, like, anyway, I'll stop. But
yeah, totally. Why do you think you use a word like seems?
Seems.
Yeah, God seems totally okay with it. This is a gen. I'm not being facetious.
In Numbers 31, it's because it's actually Moses, I believe, giving the command. And so you could make an argument that it wasn't God saying that, but the tone of that whole chapter doesn't really indicate that there was a problem with it. In Deuteronomy 20, it was God commanding. Now, I also say seems because I don't know exactly who wrote these documents.
Sure, yeah.
And so, like, I actually don't believe that it was, like, divinely co-authored. So that's why I say seems also, because I don't it's an internal critique I'm making of those who do believe that it's, you know.
Yes, gotcha.
Are we getting off track here, Justin? Sorry.
No. No, go ahead, Josh, and then we'll go to a break after you've given us a...
Oh, great. So the pressure's on to resolve this issue before the break.
It's one of the scariest biblical problems in about a minute and a half. And we'll take a break.
No, that's easy.
Sorry,
I wrote
Josh.
A book. I can do it. No, it's totally fine. I mean, I'm with you. I think that maybe my answer will be somewhat unsatisfying in that I also read... and not just stories about slavery, particularly for me, the things that I don't know what it says about my personality, but the stories that to me are more bothersome are things like, you know, what seems to be the commissioning of genocide or the slaughter of Canaanites and the men, women, and children.
That was a big one for me too. Yeah.
Yeah. Or the things that bother me are things like imprecatory psalms. They bother me less now because they just sound like metal lyrics, but you know, the, so I get it, and I don't pretend to have, you know, like, these are things that people ask me about as a pastor. I have stacks of books back here that I hand them on, like, oh, here's how Boyd works this out. Here's how Dr. Tim Mackey works this out. If you want to read, you know, like, I've got Webb, he can tell you an homiletic that might help you, or a hermeneutic that might help you with this particular thing. None of them to me are the silver bullet to questions about things like the genocide of the Canaanites or the issues with slavery. And the reason that I brought up the H&M thing wasn't, you know, to kind of pivot around the thing. It was just that to say that even if you do these interpretive, if you take these interpretive moves to try to work the thing out. So, you know, I remember a class where someone was up in arms about, you know, even New Testament writings about, like, slaves, here's how you should treat your masters, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And a professor trying to unpack different concepts of ancient Near Eastern indentured servitude and the Greek words that are translated for slaves and how it's not necessarily exactly what you think of. And I didn't mean to, like, well, if you buy H&M, then you should have no problem with it. I just mean that we assign a certain level of permission by our actions, even if intellectually we'd say, bummer, kids made this, I probably shouldn't get it. But then, you know, like it's just something that we've given cultural permission to. I think that that same kind of cultural permission is represented throughout the broken humanity depicted in the scriptures. And over all of it, you have a consistently moral God who interacts with the brokenness of that humanity. So even if I don't personally have the touchdown resolution to what the heck is going on in Numbers, where I agree seems, you know, this seems, especially for someone who does believe in a divine co-author, I'm learning to more and more, and have learned to more and more, accept a certain true enough ethic when it comes to the scriptures, meaning that I believe these things about God and God's character and the way that it's represented. I've resolved enough of my personal misgivings about the scripture to advance under the guidance of people that I think are smarter than me, who agree with me and disagree with me, and think and say that, you know, this is a scene in the movie I don't fully understand. I think that I understand the whole movie. What will this, what does this say about the entire piece of the entire body of work, if you will? And I'm not trying to advocate for an irresponsible hermeneutic that's like, if you don't get it, just forget it and have faith. But I do think, you know, like the Joan Didion quote, I use it in the book, that we tell ourselves stories to live. Everyone accepts a certain story about life in the world, and everyone accepts, lives under certain paradigms of authority in the world. And I agree completely with John in that there's no, you know, quantifiable or measurable method to come to divine authorship other than faith.
Faith.
But faith is a process that we all enter into to understand, you know, the human predicament.
We will go to a break just there. We're going to try and tackle another biggie on the other side of it, the problem of evil. See how Josh does on that one. I actually also want to talk to you, John, about where you're at in your journey, because I think it has been a kind of evolving story for you as well.
It's not as black and white
things
as it,
without talking about that.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm happy to.
Well, let's talk about that in just a moment. We're talking about deconstruction generally today on the show. Josh Porter and John Steingard are my guests. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back, and we're going long on today's show with John Steingard and Josh Porter. So we won't have any of your feedback towards the end of today's programme, but you're always welcome to send it in regard to today's show, and we will mention it and bring you some feedback on a future show. unbelievable@premier.org.uk if you want to email me. You can, of course, leave a comment over on Facebook, facebook.com/PremierUnbelievable, if you want to leave it with the Facebook post of today's show. You can leave your comments, of course, with the YouTube video as well. You can also get in touch via our new Twitter account as well, @UnbelievableFE. Next week on the show, sexuality, gender and identity. That, of course, was the discussion topic of our most recent live Unbelievable show. And we'll be playing that out on next week's show. Hear what happened when I was joined by Andrew Bunt and Charlie Bell, two same-sex attracted Christians with different views on how the church should respond to LGBT. Charlie believes in affirming gay marriage. Andrew Bunt thinks marriage should remain male-female only, and his biblical convictions have led him to celibacy. Find out about how they answered the questions of our Unbelievable audience too. Time to leap into the final part of today's discussion. So we've been talking about deconstruction on the show. This is a topic we've approached in different ways a few times over the last couple of years. But Josh Porter has written a book on it, Death to Deconstruction. It's quite a dramatic title. Of course, it's a bit more nuanced once you get into it. And he uncovers all kinds of different sort of catalysts from his own journey and the journey of others that have kind of led to a deconstruction journey, but tells his own story of how he kind of put the pieces back together again. John Steingard joins us on the show as well, and John's told us about his story before. He's summarized it again today, and we're going to continue talking about one of the specific issues that really was part of John's deconstruction journey, the problem of evil. Just before we get into that, just want to say, if you want more from Joshua, to his book, joshuasporter.com is the website. You can find John's film and creative work over at his website, steingardcreative.com. I do recommend the book. It's a really interesting read. So let's talk about the problem of evil. Do you want to sketch out, Josh, how you kind of open up this particular one in Death to Deconstruction?
Well, for me, again, my wiring and personality kind of gravitates toward morbid curiosity. And not that I like hearing or reading or learning about terrible things, but I'm sort of wired to a fault to need to understand them, or a felt need to understand them. So, you know, I'm the type of person that hears about the horrific tragedy and other people are like, oh my God, I can't hear any more of this. I need to understand all the details. And again, to a fault, obsessively almost. So the problem of evil for me was, I think, maybe the biggest challenge to my faith, to theism, to belief in God at all. And once I resolved to the idea that I would remain Christian, it almost got me again, because now I'm wrestling through what Christians believe about the problem of evil, and found some, you know, answers or some theodicies helpful, if not, you know, problematic at times. I'm not sure any one theodicy is ironclad. And then I found others more problematic than not being a Christian at all, or not believe, you know, than atheism. I've often tell people that if I were not a Christian, I would be a convinced nihilist. So I don't mean that, you know, that almost makes it sound like I'm saying that.
Did
because
your
I
band
wouldn't be,
have a, an, was it a song or an album? No, Sir, Nihilism Is Not Practical.
That's right. Yeah. See, I've been thinking about nihilism for a long time.
I think that was probably the first time I ever saw the
that
word
Nietzsche,
nihilism.
Isn't it?
Yeah, Nietzsche, nihilism. I'm into these. So, and it's not because I'm like, oh man, I just believe Christianity so much that if not, I'd be dead. I mean that my personality, my thinking gravitates to that place by default. So the problem of evil to me, and the despair that comes from a world marred by evil, became a weight too burdensome for my faith to carry, at least with the theodicy I had been given from upbringing, and then honestly with the theodicy that was offered to me from systematic theology or in seminary. And it was the kind of thing where, you know, earlier John and I were going back and forth about the scriptures, and, you know, there are certain issues where I think any of us resolve ourselves to a certain amount of ambiguity, you know, and we're like, oh, well, you know, I don't understand all of it, but it doesn't bother me that much that I don't understand all of it. And maybe something like my paradigm for the Bible is more in that realm. But the problem of evil was not. I would be that annoying person saying, yeah, but if it's this, then I cannot continue. So I take it very seriously. It's been, you know, one of my obsessions as, you know, an amateur theologian or as a pastor and as a writer. And the thing to which I've dedicated, you know, much of my teaching and writing, selfishly because it meant that much to me, but then unselfishly because, you know, like John, I think there are a lot of us that became not just a hurdle, it became a wall, a seemingly insurmountable wall.
John, has that remained a wall for you in your sort of quest for kind of coming to terms with whether there may or may not be a God?
Yes and no. So I think I have largely, and this is getting into what we were planning on talking about after this, but like I think I have largely separated theism and Christianity in my mind. And I recognize you have to get to theism first, and then you've got a lot of work to do yet to get to Christianity. But in general, like even just looking at theism, there's so many formulations of theism. So there's so many different ways you could think about the God question. Who is God? What is God? And so I think approaching the traditional sort of version of theism that most Christians would hold to. That's where I do still see the problem of evil as being pretty significant. Just briefly, it came home. I think I shared this on your show before, where I did a documentary for a nonprofit in Uganda, and I just saw children suffering horribly, the same age as my kids. And it just struck me that, like, by virtue of just being born there instead of here, their experience is that, and my kids' experience is this. And that just felt like really wrong to me, like metaphysically wrong. And so it just seemed to me that, like, if the God that I had always taught existed, if that God existed, the God that is all loving and intervenes and sets up reality in a loving way and intervenes in a loving way, that there's no way I would see this thing I'm seeing right now if that God existed. And that really, that was a real big stumbling block for me. And yeah, still probably one of the biggest barriers to belief. Although I have, I'm with you, Josh, about theodicies. I think there are some interesting ones. In your book, it seemed like you sort of endorse a modified free will defense sort of theodicy, if I get that right. And you also imported some spiritual warfare to that, which maybe was answering some questions about natural evil. Is that, am I on?
Yes, that's how I get there. Yeah.
Ballpark here. So, Josh, you can maybe expand on that if you want to. I don't want to just...
Yeah, I mean, I'd be interested in you sketching that out a bit, Josh. I mean, obviously this was a big issue for you as well, as it has been for John. So was it just a case of kind of, you know, digging through the books? You know, I know Greg Boyd's been significant sort of theologian among others in your journey here. So what was the kind of process for you, Josh?
Well, I want to say first that I'm not arguing that I have the orthodox position on the problem of evil. There are lots of different ways to resolve the problem of evil within the orthodox Christian tradition. What I am arguing is that maybe with an issue of something similar to hell, or, you know, like hell is an issue or a question mark for so many would-be or current Christians that haven't been given a spectrum of theological interpretation of, not necessarily that would resolve their issues completely, but have been given one perspective. This is the only perspective. And so they feel as if they're trapped. If I give up this perspective on something like the problem of evil or hell, then I'm no longer a Christian. Or if this is the only way to think about it, then I can't be a Christian. Whereas what I'm arguing for is a spectrum of belief. And if this is, you know, this is something that is extreme detriment to you, have you at least considered an alternative perspective, you know? And I was given by default something more in the Reformed tradition, a meticulous providence paradigm in which God is literally in unilateral control over the entire course of human history and even human freedom. And there's obviously, you know, we don't have time to unpack every perspective, but more of a Calvinistic understanding of how evil works itself out in the world. It's all contributive to the greater good. And Augustine, you know, if you could see, you see, it looks like a blot on the painting, but if you could see the whole painting, it's for the greater good. And, you know, Augustine goes as far as to suggest that evil doesn't even technically exist because it's all in service to the greater good of God's ultimate ends. And who are you? You know, like then you get into the Reformation and the John Calvin type folks being like, well, who are you to question God if that's the way he saw fit to wire the world? I found that personally not only not helpful, but it was a source of great existential crisis. You know, it's, and I couldn't make a moral sense of that God. I felt as if it's one thing to suggest that God's moral approach to providence is different than ours, but it's another thing to say that it's the opposite of ours, meaning,
yeah, unintelligible in some way. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. 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 So if it's, you know, like morally wrong to rape children, how could it ever be good sometimes for God to unilaterally decree that that exact thing happens to some greater good? And, you know, this was a source of constant battling in my theology and in seminary and then with other pastors and everything. And the place that I settled is not new. It's not novel. You know, John mentioned earlier, it's, you know, like it's honestly the C.S. Lewis answer to the question with bits of Greg Boyd's Theodicy thrown in, which again, and that combination is not novel either. But I think that it does make philosophical sense to me that love necessitates some kind of freedom or some kind of autonomy, and that love necessitates risk. And I think I hate to play this card because it's so condescending to people who aren't parents. But for me, anyway, having kids.
We're all parents here, so.
Yeah, but you guys know what I mean. It's like, oh, I know more because I'm a parent. Yeah. I think that for me, having kids, and it was something that my wife and I we actually sat down, had a conversation, a long-term conversation, decided we will now have children, and then deliberately entered into the entire process of siring children. And each of them, in turn, all three kids were according to, at least, you know, as much as we can biologically control it, a plan of ours. And this was something that honestly gave me great existential dread, is that my children will suffer and that they could suffer tremendously.
Yeah.
And I've had something of a privileged, cushy life. I mean, by way of, like John was saying, you know, I was born in the right place at the right time with the right color skin, with the right gender, to avoid a lot of the suffering that the rest of the world knows far too well. But, you know, we all suffer. We're all human beings, and pain is pain. And I've experienced pain like anyone. And even the little bit of pain that I've experienced made me think, do I want to bring another human into the world to experience this and or more pain? And somehow, strangely, and this is a process that I, you know, unpacked with God. We prayed through it. We're Christians, blah, blah, blah. And we decided that the love we already had for the kids that did not exist was worth the risk of suffering. And I, to this day, you know, believe that the inevitability of their suffering does not make me regret that they exist. And so I think that that offers me, if only a glimmer of what could possibly be the perspective of God, that love requires freedom and love requires risk, then I can enter into the C.S. Lewis understanding of, like, for authentic love and relationship to exist, there has to be autonomy. It has to be what I would describe as libertarian freedom, the genuine freedom to go this way or that way. It's the only way a meaningful universe makes any kind of sense, which inevitably creates the not just the possibility but likelihood of evil. You know, where there is autonomy, there is evil, and where there's evil, there's suffering. I can personally make sense of the inherent broken nature of the world itself and creation itself through my belief in a spiritual realm, through my belief in an overlapping reality of, you know, what Christians would call something like angels and demons, what the scriptures often call spiritual beings, or gods with a lowercase g, the idea that there's a reality overlapping ours in which there are spiritual entities that also have divinely assigned autonomy and freedom. And so that there is, like, evil and mayhem in the physical world as much as there is in the spiritual domain.
And that spiritual domain would sort of be somewhat responsible for some of the natural evil that we see and the suffering. That's part of what you're importing there, right?
Yes, it is, yeah.
Yeah. So if I can just briefly respond to that. Or Justin, go ahead.
Please go, John.
Go
ahead, John. Let's have your thoughts.
Sure. Yeah. The reason why I take issue with free will theodicies, all versions of them. And here's why. I love that you brought up your kids too, because I think about my kids a lot, and that's relevant here. So I want my kids to be able to have as much autonomy as possible, right? I want them to live a healthy life insofar as I can guide them in that direction. But there are limits to that that are also loving. So, for instance, I'm not going to let my son, like, murder my daughter, right? And as much as possible, insofar as I have the ability to do so, I'm gonna keep them from hurting each other. And any responsible parent would do that. We would all agree. Also, as they become adults, we as societies, we also put limitations on people's freedom for the same reason, because we deem it worth doing to say, like, hey, we want you to have freedom insofar as it doesn't hurt other people and doesn't violate our values. And so we're going to put limits. You know, if you murder someone else, no matter how old you are, if you get caught, you know, like that, we put limits on stuff like that. And so you would expect a God who values our freedom and who is involved in our lives to also put limits. But that's not what we see in reality. In reality, we see what seems to be like basically limitless capacity to cause suffering. And so to me, I just don't think free will defenses work, because they're placing free will at a much higher value in comparison to harm or lack of harm than we do in reality, right? Like, we don't value free will so much that we're like, well, we're going to let people murder each other because freedom, you know? So that's the basic problem I have with free will odysseys.
Yeah, that makes total sense. My disagreement would be, if I may, that...
Sure, no, please.
I do think that we allow... to a certain extent, unbridled autonomy. What we provide are consequences. So you, for example, you know, you bring up kids, and I, you know, completely agree. Any parent on their best day wants their children to have freedom within the safeguards of, but I won't let you run into traffic or some kind of thing. So
yeah,
how would you, as, you know, dad, half decent dad on your best day, prevent your kid from killing someone or jumping in front of a car? How do you intervene?
I mean, I think step one is to, like, try to teach them that that's probably not a great idea. I think we'd agree on that. I mean, like, I do think if you have to if your kid's going to run out into traffic and you have to physically save their life, then you physically save their life. Yeah. I mean, does that answer the question?
Yeah, totally. So I asked because I think if we're on the same page, I don't think we are, that I think personally that God does offer the kind of guardrails that you're talking about. By step one, you teach people a way that renders evil obsolete. You teach people a way of life in the world that works best by the author of life in the world himself, where God, I believe personally, stops short of, you know, like to use your language of literally grabbing the person out of the street, is that as far as we can tell, whether I'm right or you're right, as far as we can tell, if there is a God, he just doesn't do that kind of thing on a regular basis anyway.
It would appear not. Yeah.
It would appear not, right. So what I think is that, and this is maybe where there's a dimension of uniqueness to my personal perspective on theodicy, or at least the language that I'm comfortable with using, is that I think for there to be genuine freedom, and again, I'm just using smarter people's paradigms, but building them out a little with more words. I think for there to be general freedom, there has to be things that God cannot do. You know, and the language that Boyd uses is kind of like God, you know, he can't violate the law of contradiction. So God can't make a circular triangle and he can't make a single bachelor. So God cannot design a world that is completely free.
Yeah.
So he can't design a world or providentially in which there is complete libertarian freedom, but also not complete libertarian freedom. And for God to intervene in such a way that he violates human freedom, would necessitate that they no longer be free. As soon as you're no longer free to go this way or that way, then you're not actually free. And I think that God, the way that God enters into and communicates and teaches and draws is, you know, obviously, is in my personal theology and perspective, ever present and guiding, and the same way that I teach my kids. I offer them, mm-hmm. I give them my worldview and say, this is what I think is true about life in the world and how you live in it. And it's not just don't run in traffic, though that's a very real thing. I actually had to pull a child out of the street yesterday. And they're like, what are you doing?
Oh, that's
so that's
terrifying.
A real thing that happened.
Yeah.
But it's also, you know, things about like, this is how you talk to another person. This is how you demonstrate kindness, or this is what we believe about life in the world and how it works best. And I think that God does those things as well, but as God. So it looks different than me as a spatially located person.
I just think that commits you to a version of God that looks a lot like no God.
Do tell. Do tell.
Well, I guess we agree that it appears God does not intervene, even in situations where you would expect God to want to. You know, you would expect God to want to intervene.
To clarify, yes, what I meant is that I don't think that it's often the case. I wouldn't go as far as to say that it's never the case, because I don't know. I haven't heard anybody with a story like this that, you know, like the giant hand from the end of the stand comes down and grabs the person out of traffic. But I do, you know, I'm charismatic in my theology, so I do believe in things like miracles and supernaturals, sure, this and that. So I do think that there is a level of intervention that one might describe as supernatural, but I do think it's probably the case that they are the exception to the rule rather than the rule itself, meaning God doesn't by default heal every bout of cancer or grab the person out of the street. But sorry, I didn't mean to step on what you were saying.
No. I guess I just think that, like, I think all versions of the problem of evil and all theodicies, as you said earlier, I agree with you. I think all versions on both sides are not knocked down. I agree with that.
Yes.
And so I think you have to then go to an approach of, like, what view makes better sense of the world that we see in front of us. And to me, at least the tri-omni God, you would expect the world to look different if that God existed. At least it seems to me. There's features about reality as we see it that seem to be explained by an indifferent universe a lot better than by a tri-omni God. That's just my view. I know both of you guys here disagree, and yeah, so that's totally cool. But that's my view on problem of evil.
I don't disagree completely. I honestly have a lot of respect for your perspective, John. I think it has a lot of integrity and consistency. And I do often talk about what I believe is a chaotic indifference in the created order itself. I think, you know, and I'm giving myself, you know, some amount of grace here, but I think that on my best day, I am trying to give my, you know, my church as a pastor or my readers as a writer an honest assessment of a world that is horrifying. You know, I am not an optimist. And, you know,
am an optimist, but
I'm not. I'm not. I'm really not by default. And I default toward, you know, unlike you, maybe toward cynicism and despair. And I'm, you know, I'm the kind of person that, like, in the last few years, we've all seen the world kind of undone by great cultural upendings through things like the pandemic or police brutality or the, you know, mass shootings, those kinds of things. But I'm the kind of person who's also looking in between the 24-hour news cycle at, like, the horrifying story that happened in an apartment that nobody that didn't make the big headlines. Mm-hmm. And those are the things that, to me, make me honestly put my head down at my desk and say, what are we doing and what is this place? So I don't pretend to be the person who's like, I've worked it out. I'm comfortable with my theodicy, and therefore I'm never undone by the brokenness of the world. I'm right there with you. And I do see a chaotic indifference to the universe. I think chaos theory is, you know, one of my most helpful paradigms in understanding the problem of evil, and something that I work with in the book as well. But I have resigned myself to an understanding of God that I would concede to you is not the way that I would expect a tri-omni God to run the universe. Though I think that, you know, the omni language is often unhelpful because it's so nuanced.
Yeah. And I guess at the center of it all, I'm guessing in your theology, Josh, is the person of Jesus Christ. You wouldn't necessarily expect a God to get crucified and experience that pain and suffering in his own body. At the end of the day, I guess I'm interested in kind of, without wanting to put a pretty bow on it or anything like that, because everyone's story is an evolving one. What kind of, despite all of those catalysts, you know, the problem of evil, all the things, other things you list in your book as potential, you know, stumbling blocks and pathways to deconstruction. What was it that, if there is something you can say overall, kind of led you through all of that to a place where you could say, actually, I still think the God who became known to us in Jesus Christ makes more sense than all the other options I could have deconstructed into?
Well, it's a hopelessly Sunday school sounding answer, but honestly, the person of Jesus was the most compelling case for the Christian movement for me consistently throughout the entire process. As a kid, trying to find my place in evangelical church world of the Deep South, as an adolescent, asking questions that were not welcomed by the evangelical world of the Deep South, as an young adult deconstructing as somebody who was wrestling through doubt and faith or despair, you know, even as a pastor, even as somebody who's, you know, throughout seminary, the consistent thread to me that I could not shake was the person of Jesus. And, you know, like John, I allowed myself the possibility of other worldviews. I was never, you know, I like John, was someone who was like, I can separate Christianity from theism itself. I need to figure out if I believe God exists. And then if he does, that doesn't resolve the issue of Christianity. That only gets me to a place where, like, well, great, now I have even more questions. It would be more comfortable at some point to just be like, forget it. but, you know, Jesus to me was, and I don't pretend to be, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say I studied every world religion, but, you know, I entered into a process of investigation, and I could not shake the person of Jesus, the teachings of Jesus, and specifically the manifesto of Jesus, the Sermon on the Mount, and paired together with the documents of Jesus' life, mostly, you know, in those first century biographies of his life, and the great amount of ink spilled over those writings, and the wonderful things done in the world because of them, the horrible things done in the world because of them, I wanted to find a way to retain allegiance to Jesus or faithfulness to Jesus or Jesus as some kind of central spiritual guru, teacher, master, whatever, however you want to describe him, that would not include a traditional reading of the scriptures or not include a traditional of understanding of the scriptures. But, you know, in my personal journey, the more that I tried to do those things, the more I felt as if Jesus was drawing me to both of those things, to an Orthodox perspective of the Christian movement. So Jesus was the linchpin. And then honestly, for me, the paradigm of discipleship as spiritual formation, presented as somebody like a Dallas Willard, was the thing that brought me back into what I would describe as the, you know, ancient, historic, apostolic Christian movement. I think that this is something that I've used a lot in talking about the book, but honestly, it enables me to wrap my head around Christianity as something more intimate and also bigger than I was led to believe at a certain point. And that's, you know, the analogy of like a kid walking into a boxing gym and finding a coach and saying, "Teach me." And if they do that, they will have to inherit a worldview and a perspective on how to treat their body and what to eat and how to order their time and how to condition themselves and where they're going as a result that will be completely unlike the world around them. And the world around them will be like, oh, you're doing it wrong, or you're wasting your life, or you should do it this way or that way. But they will be beholden to a master. They will be the apprentice, and they will enter into that lifelong process. Mm-hmm. You know, as someone who is always loves the training montage in the movie, that was the thing that gave me an in back into the church, back into the idea of spiritual formation, the idea of shared life and community. I don't believe that I think maybe because of the nature of the title of the book and the fact that I wrote a book at all, one might assume that it's a book designed to convince someone of my perspective. And maybe in a way it is, but honestly, you know, I say in the opening and the finale, that's like, I don't know where this finds you, and I'm honestly not trying to do a trick that convinces you back into Christianity.
Well, that's a good segue to you, John, because, you know, I'd just be fascinated to know where you are now. You felt like you had to pull theism and Christianity apart. Has anything kind of stayed together in that process? Would you still describe yourself as a sort of atheist agnostic? Is there another label?
It's funny. The whole way through this process, I at various times I had people say like, oh, so you don't believe in God, so you're an atheist. And my instinct always, every time, was like, no, I'm not an atheist. And it's like, well, you know, but then I'd have people like, well, describe what you think, and you're an atheist. And I always just felt like uncomfortable with the word. I've always tried to get to the bottom of that. And I think part of it is, like we talk about words like deconstruction or whatever, having multiple meanings. And I think atheist is one of those too. I guess the closest thing I would describe myself to is just agnostic, in the sense that like, I don't know if God is out there. I actually would prefer some version of theism to be true. Like if I could pick, right? Mm-hmm. Like I like the idea that reality has teleology built into it, like a purpose, a telos. Like I like the idea that I'm a part of a grander story. I like the idea that this is all going somewhere, and that somewhere is good. Like I want all of that. So I'm actually quite open to theism, and more recently I've gone digging for like, okay, I've spent a few years like really like figuring out what I can't believe. Now, like, what could I believe? So there are some interesting arguments for theism. I think studying consciousness really opened that up for me. Like, I'm not a physicalist anymore. I lean towards panpsychism or idealism. We don't have to get into any of that, but that sort of opened me up to being...
That's for another show.
Yeah,
for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. So like that philosophy of mind, it put basically like, I think a mutual friend of ours, Cameron Bertuzzi, he said, you either lean more and more towards matter being fundamental or more and more towards mind being fundamental. And there's consequences to that. And I think I've gone more that mind seems more fundamental to me. So that sort of begs some questions about like when we say God, what might we mean by that? So I am open to theism in general, and like I said, in some ways I'd prefer it. It's when we start getting into specifics like the tri-omni God that the problem of evil start coming up for me, you know, a lot of the things that we've talked about before, Justin. So ultimately, I have tried to approach life with as open hands as I possibly can. I actually like I've studied I've been developing a meditation practice over the last year, because I do think one of the things that is missing, like you lose some significant things when you leave Christianity, right? Like even if it's not true, you still lose community, you lose practice. There's all these things that have benefit. Mm-hmm. And so I got into a few different versions of meditation practice and kind of landed on Vipassana and Zen Buddhism as being really helpful. So I don't know. I'm open to weird stuff out there, guys. Like I just really need it to show up in my life in a way that's real, and I need my beliefs in them to be justified. And I haven't been able to get there with Christianity, and it feels unlikely to me, but you know, who knows?
Well, no, we're not expecting you to be converted by the end of this show.
I was, but that's not why we're here.
We are going to have to draw this to a close, I'm afraid, because time is against us at this point. But Josh, any final words? Because obviously John is where he is, you know, and what. I mean, and again, not with a view to kind of trying to convert him in the dying moments of the show, but what would you say to someone in John's position who says, I'm open, the story's not closed, I've already kind of changed my mind a bit on the whole theism question, I'm leaning in a sort of, you know, more of a consciousness mind direction. I mean, do you think the door is open for someone like John to maybe walk back into another kind of iteration of Christianity at some point?
Well, it sounds like what John is saying, that the door is open for him to continue to explore and figure out what he thinks, just as the door is open for me to continue to explore and figure out what I believe. I mean, honestly, he's doing what all of us are doing our best to do on our best day, which is take the tools and resources that we've been given to understand ourselves and the human predicament and life in the world as best as we can, with or without belief in God or Christianity or meditation or whatever it might be. So I, you know, I'm right there with you. I think that, yes, sir, John.
Oh, well, there's this like thought I stumbled across. You mentioned C.S. Lewis earlier, and it's like, this thought is something that's been very helpful for me that I think all three of us would probably like appreciate and agree on. There's this, this Catholic philosopher named Eleanor Stump, who sort of championed this idea that if you spend your life in service of the good and seeking the good, that in some way you, when you get to the end of your life, you know, she's Catholic, so she believes in God. And she believes if you spend your life sort of in service of the good and trying to live right and serve others and seek out goodness, that you will find at the end of your life that it was the source of that goodness that you were serving the whole time. And that's very Matthew 25, parable of the sheep and the goats. Like, is this how you lived? Did you seek out goodness? Did you serve the people around you? Did you seek to alleviate the suffering of others? C.S. Lewis, in his book, The Last Battle, touches on that with the story about Tash, right? And the donkey who thought he was serving Tash, the animal that thought he was serving Tash his whole life. And Aslan said, you know, if you, whatever your fealty and your loyalty
to Tash. The
cattle
mean soldier, I think. Mm-hmm.
There we go.
That's right. Yes.
That idea is a very helpful one for me, because then I go like, look, if God exists or if God doesn't, goodness is worth chasing and worth living your life in service of. And I know we can have philosophical arguments about like, well, how do you know what's good? But like, for the most part, like, we know, right? Like, we know the difference between a life lived in service of goodness and one that's not. And insofar as we can determine that, we should do it, you know? And I think that's a comforting thought for me, that whatever, if God is real, God lies at the end of that path, you know?
Yeah. And John, I wanted to say to you that, thanks for being so kind and sociable and open-minded. I think honestly, you know, it's whether you are a resolved Christian or a journeying spiritualist or something else, I hope that all of us would, you know, myself absolutely included, learn a certain open-mindedness with which we approach the world. I don't think that resolved belief and open-mindedness are contradictory. And,
agreed.
You know, mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that, you know, I honestly, you know, I enter into conversations like these not knowing exactly how they're going to go, because I wrote a book with such a provocative name. Like, oh, somebody's going to be mad at me. So honestly, it's really refreshing to just have a totally peaceful and kind-hearted and gracious conversation, even if, like, you disagree on some really core things and agree on some other things. At the end of the day, we can have a conversation and say, yeah. Oh, okay, great, thanks.
Well, and Justin, you're great at hosting those kinds of conversations. So,
well, yeah. No, I've hardly had to do anything today. You guys have really led it, and it's been great. So thank you so much, Josh and John. It's been great to hear about both your journeys and just have some of that interaction on some of those issues as well along the way. I hope maybe we can do this again, check in on how the journeys are going in due course. But for now, I will repeat again, if you want Josh's book, Death to Deconstruction, joshuasporter.com is a good place to go. Links are with today's show. John, you can find over at steingardcreative.com as well. But for now, Josh and John, thanks for being with me.
Oh, dude,
thanks so much, guys.
Look forward to hearing what you made of today's show. Do email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. By the way, if you enjoy conversations about faith, you might want to be part of the live conversation that's happening with the Unbelievable London Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group coming up on Monday the 13th of February, 7 p.m. A Tumultuous Period in Apologetics with Josh Parikh is the subject. You can be with them at the Cock Tavern near King's Cross and Euston Stations. That's this Monday, the 13th of February at 7 p.m. Meetup.com is where to go to find out more. You're looking for the
Unbelievable London Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group. Always a good time with the guys who run that one. And if you like Unbelievable, we think you'll love our other shows as well. Ask NT Wright Anything. This last week, Tom was answering personal questions, including whether he ever struggles with his own faith. On matters of life and death, John and Tim Wyatt continued to talk cryptocurrency, the ethics of technicism, the parable of the talents, get-rich-quick schemes, and the wheat and the weeds. On the C.S. Lewis podcast, Ruth continued to talk to Alistair McGrath about his biography, C.S. Lewis: A Life, looking at some key moments in Lewis's Oxford career, such as the death of his father. And they're also running that competition to win copies of Alistair McGrath's C.S. Lewis: A Life. You just need to register at the website to be entered into that. And also on Unapologetic, Ruth continues her conversation with journalist Lauren Windle on being single and dating in a marriage-obsessed church. That's what they're talking about at the moment. So loads of great podcasts for you to explore. PremierUnbelievable.com is the place where you can find them all. Or just search them up. Wherever you get your podcast from. Loads of articles as well that we've published in the past week on the website. One of them is by Heather Tomlinson. Working for peace in our politically divided world is essential, she writes, but the church needs to get its own house in order too. With discussions, of course, around sexuality at the Church of England's General Synod this past week, she's looking at tribalism within the church. So again, premierunbelievable.com for all our podcasts, all our articles. And of course, registering for the newsletter gets you that free ebook, Googling God, answering the top five most Googled questions about faith. For now, thanks for being with us, and we'll see you next time. And next time will be that live show that we just hosted on sexuality, gender, and identity. Hear what happened when I was joined by Andrew Bunt and Charlie Bell, talking about how the church should respond to LGBT, particularly in light of the Church of England's recent moves in terms of blessing same-sex partnerships, but not apparently changing their doctrine on marriage. Well, you can hear what happened same time next week. For now, God bless. Thanks for being with us. See you next time.